Welcome to the Fat Tonys Podcast, where we bridge the gap between everyday life and expert insight. Join us in conversation with real-world experts, gaining practical advice and strategies to navigate the complexities of the modern world.
Joan Shields, a.k.a. Homegrown Joan, a.k.a. Auntie Joan, a.k.a. the Mater Familias of the Fat Tonys community. Welcome. You're a very well-loved member of the Fat Tonys community, but for those who don't know you, could you just give us a bit of an introduction, tell us about your background?
First of all, thank you. Wow, that's really nice of you, and what an honor. I am a born and bred New Yorker that is married to a retired fireman. We have two grown kids. We live on Long Island in a small little home. We worked our lives in New York City, family and friends, Long Island, New York City, New York metro area. And I come from a very large family that many don't know this. I was raised mostly by my mother's traditions and her family, who are Italian Americans. But I also have a father that people aren't aware of, who is German, Irish, and Swiss. And we joke, we don't share much that his parents died much younger. So I was truly raised with the traditions of Italian American, first, second, third generation. I actually lived with my grandmother in Queens for a while when I was going to nursing school. So these are all my heritage came from there, but New Yorker, born and bred.
Wow. I've got to say, Joan, before we start recording, when we're having a chat, you apologized for your accent, which I think is absolutely criminal because I think you have a wonderful accent. From an English point of view, it's just, it's phenomenal.
Well, that is a real compliment because I'm afraid of what I've done to the English language. And I try, I practice before I make my videos in the garden. I practice and it's so funny, but it is what it is. And I know I get a lot of jokes about it. As a matter of fact, my family and friends said, once they hear your voice, they're going to turn the podcast off after 5 minutes. And I thought about that, if I may. If people are only going to listen for 5 minutes, I hope they hear this loud and clear. I'd like to use this platform to talk about nurses. Global nurses are hurting. Healthcare facilities, hospitalizations are collapsing. We were on life support long before COVID showed up. And you'll look at the NHS. Hospitals are closing. ERs are closing. If you live in a countryside or rural America, you are limited to your healthcare access. And COVID exacerbated the problem by not protecting healthcare workers. And they left bedside nursing when they saw their family and friends and coworkers die. And when I say nurses, I want this loud and clear. I'm talking from nursing students, they care for your family, way up to nurse scientists, nurse practitioners. These are the backbone. A nurse's aide, a nurse's assistant are the backbone of healthcare. And across the globe, it is collapsing. We have a shortage now of staffing. And people are literally dying in ERs because the wait is so long. So what I'm going to ask your audience to do, if you can, contact your local hospital, healthcare facility. Many times they're a whole system, and let those administrators know this is, if anything, the precautionary principle. If you hire enough staff, you prevent accidents, errors, problems. So the money invested in protecting the staff is in the long term protecting life. People are dying from low staffing. So shout out to all the nurses, and we need you all around the world. Look at your area. It is a serious, deadly matter, and it's getting worse. So thank you for that moment.
No, thank you. This is a really interesting concept. I didn't realize you were going to start with this, but I have so many questions here. I'm not sure if you're aware, and I'm sure many people listening won't be aware, but I started off my career in the healthcare service here in England. as a graduate, and I was a manager of an A&E department, I think an emergency department, as they're called in America, for a couple of years. So I've seen this side of a coin, and I've managed nurses and tried to run a department. Quite a young and experienced person, put in quite an awkward position. But what I saw is, or what I think is really interesting, you're talking about it collapsing worldwide. And when you hear the arguments online, it always comes back to, you know, everything's divided these days. So it's, oh, we need socialized healthcare in America. It's too private. And I agree, I get it. But then in the UK, where we have one of the most socialized healthcare systems in the world, it's also facing the exact same problems you just discussed. COVID exposed the exact same structural issues that you just discussed, like the ultimate stress test, if you will. So I think just saying, oh, we need this ideology or this ideology is a little bit too simple sometimes. And also what I witnessed through my time in healthcare is that, ironically, I think considering that ideologically the British and American systems are at opposite ends of the scale, the root causes, in my opinion, of a lot of these problems are the same. You know, you've got a lot of heavy layers of management. You've got lobbying groups which do not allow the inefficiencies to go down. You've got vested self-interest. You've got nepotism. And it's interesting that it can plague both of these systems.
Oh my goodness. Everything you said, I could relate to. So we're in from different healthcare systems, exact same problems. And who suffers in the end? People, all of us, not just nurses afraid of losing their license. You know, now it was afraid of losing their life. They were having nurses come in with COVID. As long as your symptoms were mild, come work. So I happened to witness the change in the 80s. I think it was 87. It's called diagnostic related groups. And I worked a post-op surgical unit. Now, imagine if you had an appendectomy. You came into the hospital, you would anticipate somewhere about a 5-day post-op stay in the hospital. And I was the nurse that took care of you. They decided to take those hospitalizations and give them a code of days. And instead of 5 days or as needed, you had 1 to 2 days. They eliminated that day before admission, where you got to know the patient. And now they shortened your number of hospital stays, meaning the people that are patients are sicker. I don't have that person that's doing much better 5 and 6 days after their gallbladder removal or what have you. And on top of that, they cut nursing staff. So when I used to have a unit of 8 patients and 1 nurse's aide, I had 12 and sharing a nurse's aide. And yet we still tried to strive to do it right when we should have been, hell no, we're not doing this. Nurses don't like to strike. It's a really difficult place to strike. You know, if you strike and walk that picket line, somebody will die. It's a terrible, terrible situation. And it got worse. So those are, so, and then of course, healthcare costs. And if you just see the amount of mistakes could be cut, the amount of costs would be saved instead of cutting corners in the spaces that you need them the most. So that's a horrible thing. I had no idea about your experience in the A&E. Oof, you saw a lot. Friday and Saturday nights must have been fun.
It was a baptism of fire, certainly. And I can, again, you know, I can identify with exactly what you're saying. I saw the rise, or I was working in the midst of what we would call a kind of coding arms race, where everything was being broken up and divided into clinical coding for informatics. And it was all about grouping these things, you know, atomizing the patient journey and coding as much as possible, getting that in a basket and charging for it. And even, you know, even though it's free at the point of care here, the government will be paying. And so there's an arms race between the hospitals to create as many of these clinical coding things as possible and charge, and the government trying to reduce them. And I always got on far better with the nurses and the doctors than the other managers, because what I saw on the shop floor was them fighting a battle from two sides. They had the management coming down on them, saying, oh, you know, you've got to be more efficient, or you've got to prioritize this, or you've got to do this with less resources. But then they have the public coming on them, expecting, you know, better service than what was being given, expecting quicker service. So they're kind of trapped in the middle. It was an awful thing. And the absentee rates of nurses that I remember was just absolutely astronomical, going through the roof. A lot of it to do with exhaustion. I think a huge amount of it was to do with mobility issues from years of inadequate lifting equipment or broken lifting equipment. So having to, you know, turn patients over constantly, and that just destroyed their bodies over time.
Yep. Yeah. Oh boy, you really do know it. I could see why you left.
I think it's fair to say I definitely became disillusioned with the bureaucracy. There's arguments over here that you know, we need more funding. From what I saw, there's more than enough funding. There's just so much being scraped off at the bureaucratic layer, and it's not reaching, you know, the clinicians, the nurses, the doctors, the patients.
And you see who it is reaching, though. Where are the resources going? Are to pharmaceuticals. Tremendous. If I could segue this into my organic gardening journey, because my grandmother was raised on a farm in Flushing, Queens, New York City, and they lived off of the fat of the land. And during the Depression, during the war, all these things. And when she got married, and they bought a very small house and small property, and she grew her own food on a very small amount of land, and I learned how to do that. So fast forward to 2008, I had been sick, and I was in huge medical debt. Even though my husband was a city fireman, they did not accept his city health insurance through the FDNY. After they took my health coverage, I had $350,000 of debt and
wow.
U.S. dollars. And I'm sick and I wasn't working. And that took away my salary to run our household. I live on 40 by 100 feet, very small property. I said, how can I save my house and not get into more debt? And one way was through food. At the very same time, the American Nurses Association had asked us to educate the public on local organic foods grown without all the extra pesticides that leave residues, that protect the soil, and not antibiotics. And the reason antibiotics, I speak about this, is because in the U.S., 80% of all antibiotics sold are used in agriculture. I didn't know that.
Wow.
Because I was sick, the oncology group gave me registered dietitian, and she told me that. I didn't know when the American Nurses Association said, don't use antibiotics. I said, in agriculture, I was clueless. I didn't know that they were doing this.
So why is that? Is that to prevent losses to livestock, to animals, or is it just to make the meat healthier at the end?
No, it's the cause of antimicrobial resistance. What it does, and there's no denying, it is in their feed, and it helps them grow quicker. You'll see farmed fish all around the world are given a feed that has antibiotics. And you want to look, if you're getting fish, purchasing fish, that it was raised without antibiotics or wild caught. Unfortunately, the farmed fish have escaped and they're out breeding with the wild. But I didn't know any of that. A lot of cows, pigs, Carbadox is this new one that I thought they had banned back in 2016. I keep up on the antibiotics. This is a cancer-causing antibiotic that was supposed to be removed in 2016, mostly for hogs, pigs, pork production, and they didn't. It was lobbied by the Pork Association, and now it's back up on the docket again. This is contributing to antimicrobial resistance, which is in the top five causes of global deaths, and it's getting worse. And they do it to fatten the chickens, fatten the cows, fatten the pigs, quickly, fish. But it's also for the very crowded as a preventative measure. And we all know antibiotics are only supposed to work when there's a positive bacterial infection. So you'll see that tied in with COVID when we have things like tuberculosis. If you were diagnosed with an active case of TB, you're getting an antibiotic. It's not working anymore. And drug-resistant tuberculosis is spreading. And I personally, in going back 2008, I had a staph infection that was MRSA, MRSA, from a bone marrow tap. That if you saw, I have a little hip problem from now. When I had my daughter, I had a life-threatening staph infection, antibiotic resistance. I wasn't allowed near her for 2 weeks because of how severe and the chills and the fever that didn't go away. I went septic. So this became a personal journey, and I learned more and more as I got older. And now that I know the system with agriculture, also there are animals that get sick, and of course they're going to medicate them, but that's the only time it should. And if we didn't have such cramped quarters to raise all these animals, they wouldn't need these antibiotics. And that's where agricultural, chemical, and pharmaceutical companies all tie into one. Bayer bought Monsanto, and that is a chemical, a pharmaceutical, and an agricultural company controlling all of this. We all saw what happened with glyphosate, Roundup, the number one pesticide used in the world. When Monsanto was bought by Bayer, we found out they were lying about its safety. That, too, is an antimicrobial. Kills. It actually was originally patented as an antibiotic. So these things affect our health, and that's how I started growing more, just to save money, because I was in so much debt from medical debt. We took up a deck. I have very small property. We took up part of my front lawn. I put an apple tree, a fig tree, and I grow a lot of food. I grow up vertically, and I do really well teaching people how to do it.
That's really fascinating. This was born out of necessity to an extent.
Yes.
But then, ironically, we've come full circle because, you know, going back to healthcare, when I worked in the system, they were terrified of MRSA, and there was a huge rise in these, you know, antibiotic-resistant viruses are sweeping through hospitals. More and more people are dying from them. And, you know, it's a genuine concern. I saw a tweet that you reminded me of. I can't remember who it was by, but I thought it was really poignant because someone said this era between the end of World War II and two decades from now will be remembered as the antibiotic century, because after that, they're going to stop working through overuse. And people will look back at this golden age where we had all these antibiotics that we kind of abused to a large extent. And so you went through this journey, you started learning more and more about the overuse of antibiotics, the overuse of pesticides. You know, I think you mentioned on your Instagram account, you know, the FDA policies for antibiotics and pesticides in the food supply, they're run by agricultural companies. There's a huge amount of lobbying there. When you started to go more and more into that, did you notice health benefits through doing, you know, growing your own food, through going down that journey? Or was it more of a philosophical stance initially of, I just don't want to participate in that overuse of antibiotics?
My vitamin D levels have been within normal levels since I've been outside so much more growing my old food. And otherwise, I get a little anemic. I grow a lot of beans. So I know when I can walk up a flight of stairs and I'll have a pounding headache it's called a temporal headache, like on the side of my head. I know immediately without having blood work, oh, my iron levels are going. It's just a side effect of chemo on my spleen. Common for others. This isn't some violin come out for me. It is what it is, but I can control it. And because of that, I started growing more beans. I eat more meat. I support very local farmers. My sister happens to live in farm country in Warwick, New York. So I get a lot of farm food, meat right from the farm. I get my milk, eggs, and cheese delivered to my door. I don't go out to dinner. Forget COVID and staying away from indoors. But before that, we cut that out. The seed oils and all those kinds of things. Right now, I'm drinking tea that I grew myself. So it's not just the savings, it's the flavor. And I'm able to keep myself healthy just by growing that garden. And knowing, if anything else, the satisfaction of knowing exactly where the food came from is a huge relief, you know, so that's the medical benefit as well. But my lab values are all within normal limits, knock wood, and I'm doing great. So that's a big one.
It's really interesting. So, you know, I'm a city boy. I grew up in a city. I live in London now, which is a huge city. I've never set foot on a farm in my life that I can remember. I certainly wouldn't know how to go about growing my own food, even a small vegetable patch in my garden. So for someone like me, and I'm quite ignorant of food as well, which is a failing on my part, but for someone like me, if you were to give me some kind of advice, like a power law, you know, like a Pareto's law where, you know, 20% of the effort can give you 80% of the benefit. What can I do short of growing my own food, which, you know, I live in central London. I just can't do that where I live. Are there any, what other things can I do?
I've grown food for people on their balconies. My daughter lived in Miami. My girlfriend lives right up the road from Central Park on the 7th floor. We grow food on balconies for people who live in apartments. You can grow, even if you grow enough vitamin C, vitamin K through vegetables, green leafy vegetables have the vitamin K. Those kind, you can grow. Beans. Beans grow vertically, so you can have a whole wall of beans on a balcony and give yourself some privacy from your neighbor in the apartment next door. So I'm going to take that back from you. But otherwise, in your area, I don't know other countries, but you could look for community gardens. You could look for, we have CSAs where people grow the food and deliver it to your house, like I participate with the milk. And that just try to support the stores near you that are selling from the local farmers. Do you have farmers markets in London?
We do.
Ah, there you go. And talk to the farmers. They love to share their info. They want you to come to their farm. I have yet to see one farmer at the farmers market that said, no, you better not come here. They show you directly. We'll walk you in their barn. I've walked through fields. So I have, just so you know, I have helped. When we realized that there was always, I don't know if you ever heard of the March Against Monsanto. This, I don't know when it started, but I joined it in 2014 on Long Island. And I said, you know what, let me do something. I started handing out seeds. Anybody who came and asked about the march, I handed out seeds. And then at Halloween, the kids are coming for goodies, but I have seeds and all info about how organic gardens raise your property taxes, and I give out free seeds. And then 2015 was the big march against Monsanto. I joined New York City, and it was tremendous. And it was a gorgeous day. And I said, what the hell are we walking down Fifth Avenue from for? We should be planting gardens. And about 15 of us gals got together, and we started a garden club, and we started growing and planting gardens in inner cities. We did Philly, Camden, New Jersey. Phoenix took an empty lot and grew it. Miami, and of course, New York. It can be done, and I can teach people how to do it for free. And the best way is to have someone hand you a pack of seeds. It makes you say, all right, I'll grow it. And when you taste that first tomato, a carrot, or see a little kid plant a green bean and it starts to grow real quick, kids will eat more vegetables when they grow it themselves. Something like 65% increase in fruit and vegetable consumption from anyone who grows their own food. So that's how it's so exciting. And I was doing it on social media, and I had a really great Facebook page, and I started sharing seeds. And all I said is upload pictures of you planting the seeds or something with the kids. And I was getting, and that's where Shills, I know you know about Shills. That's where Shills came in. Suddenly, I didn't know this was going on. I was very naive about what trolls and shills meant. I knew there were front groups, but I didn't realize the extent of having them planted as accounts all over social media to discredit people. And if let's keep it real, if it wasn't for Nassim, we probably wouldn't have met you and me this way at all.
True.
Right? There is a very large platform of people that follow him for so many different reasons. A lot of conversations that are had, I don't even understand the topic, so I stay out of the arguments, but I do know what he went through, because I went through it too. Apparently, they measure the algorithm of interaction on social media, and I was getting a lot of interaction on Facebook, and it was organically, no pun intended, grown. I had something like 40,000 followers. I don't have a Facebook account anymore because of what they did. They took a video of my 4-year-old nephew that I had uploaded planting in the garden. And they removed the video, kept my name and my avatar and my words, and replaced it with black slave children working in the fields. I knew none of this happened until suddenly people were coming to my page given me a lot of crap about it. It's like, what are they talking about? I'm not racist. What the fuck was this? And that's when I saw there were 188 comments on this one person looking to tag the New York State Nurses Association, that I should have my license revoked, that I must be anti-vax because I grow organic, all based on this lie that they just took this. The followers came to my page and they posted my husband's social security number. Do you know what they are? I don't know what you have in the UK. What do you have in London? Okay. We have, you know what that is, a social security number.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now you're assigned one at birth, but they posted, it was my name with his number. And I had to get in contact with our family member services. I said, I have a real problem here. These were teachers that did this. I had a professor accuse me of deleting tweets and posts because I knew I was wrong, as I never deleted it, and came back and said, I'm using your lie in a lecture. Wow. So I picked up the phone, not knowing this was a shill, and called the supervisor of that university. And I showed them everything. I did not delete my tweets. They're here. I'm getting threats. I'm getting ridiculous accusations. And they came back and said, we assessed this and don't think they did anything wrong. I said, what is wrong with you? This would never be allowed, just to lie. And that's what they do. And the accusations are crazy. To call me anti-vax is the funniest thing. Well, if you grow organic, you must be an anti-vaxxer. This is what they do. They just make up lies. Make them up. Wow. And they did that with Nassim. They portrayed him with Nazis. They portrayed my daughter with Nazis. Wow. She's Hitler's henchman because she follows me. And to this day, I have had two doctors, medical doctors, with their affiliates, accusing me of being a Trump apologist, Nassim Taleb apologist, and an anti-vaxxer. What the hell? I'm posting videos of my mother showing her big muscle that she got the vaccine in February of 2021. Like, how dare you? So this is what they do. And then you become a lunatic trying to defend your innocence. And then this is one account, Vixen Valentino. This is an anonymous account that is on top of every one of these dirty, rotten shills. And that person told me, have you ever heard of Nassim Taleb? So yeah, you should see what they did to him. I didn't know he was even on social media. And that went back to his precautionary principle. He didn't say GMOs are the worst thing in the world, that you're going to die. He said, take precaution. And these GMOs, most of them are Roundup Ready GMOs, meaning they are coated with Roundup. They're genetically edited so that you can spray as much Roundup as you want, and that plant won't die when Roundup / glyphosate is intended to kill plants, weeds. So all the weeds around it will die, but not the plant because it's a Roundup Ready. He was 100% right. The environment has been damaged because of it. Everything he said was mostly about the environmental consequences and the fact that these weren't tested in human studies. And he was crucified for it as if he said things that was not said. The evidence is in his paper. I've referred to it many times. It's a caution. And of course you want to take caution. And you know what? Organic food tastes better when you grow it out your back door anyway. So keep your GMO sugar beets or soybeans or what have you. And that's what I have in common with Nassim.
I mean, I'm glad you can laugh about it now. That sounds absolutely horrific. Sounds like an absolutely terrible thing to have to go through. Now, I think what's quite alarming, you alluded to this in the past when we talked, but I had no idea it was to this extent. And, you know, I think what's really interesting is when people think about shills and bad actors online and this kind of attack, they think of it in terms of maybe people like Nassim, who's got a million followers, or at a state level, even where they think, you know, Russian bots flooding or Chinese bots flooding social media to prop up an idea of a regime or an ideology. What's alarming about your case is it just shows it can happen to anyone, like a completely normal person who's just trying to educate and just share, you know, awareness about good food can get targeted and deliberately try to have their lives destroyed. by these huge companies. You know, it's a real David and Goliath thing. And what I love about you is, you know, you haven't given up. I know you've had a few different accounts now. You mentioned you're not on Facebook anymore, but, you know, you still have a strong presence on Instagram. You know, you've bounced back on Twitter. And I just think it's really good that you have that resilience to come back from that, because I'm not sure I could have done. I think I would have, you know, closed my social accounts and kind of ran off. So that's amazing. It's inspirational as well.
Well, thank you for that, because there are times that you wonder, why would I even need social media? But then there are three different people that never planted, just like you, never planted a seed and grew a tomato, who I sent seeds to, and they are now teaching people how to grow food. They're making YouTube videos, and they have big garden parties and whatnot. Oh my gosh! And I share that. I think, you know, that was definitely worth it, because to heal ourselves, we start with the food. To heal the environment, you start with the food. Right out your back door, I'm composting, so my soil is better. I'll have rainwater collected, and then I filter it through soil, so it cleans it a little better, and that's how I'll water my garden. When it rains, I can't help it. I got acid rain. I'm right, JFK's right down the road from me, so I'm going to have acid rain. I do the best that I can. And I also learned to how to jar food, garden, you know, save and preserve, not just freeze it. So that's really fun too. And I'm looking at my grandniece today. My niece sent me a video of my grandniece eating apples from my tree. I made some applesauce, and she was, you know, she's a baby and she's eating. So that is, who can knock that? How could they possibly say this is not better? So they tried. It was rough. There was, oh God, Seb, there was one particular, I've shared our experience, and I have permission to share this. My son has battled and has won recovery. He's in recovery just 3 years now. He just celebrated his third year of sobriety from opioids. And that was beyond. 2020 wasn't just COVID for me. We had to, thankfully, got him into rehab, and it worked this time beautifully. And he's so successful and doing so well. But one time earlier in 2016, he was at his first Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I went and I left my phone in the car just to not be distracted at all. And when I came out, and by the time I got home, my phone was blowing up with all these texts from family and friends that I was being accused of being someone else, arguing. And they said, oh, that's Joan. I know it. They used the word whatever, shithead or skank or something. And I was like, I wasn't. They're like, where were you? I was like, I was at my meeting with Matthew. And it was just beyond that. You can't, I could not, he did not give me permission to talk about it back then. So I couldn't defend myself of where I was and how I was nowhere near a computer texting this argument out. And I've been accused of a lot of different accounts. The funniest is when they say I'm GMO free USA. I said, well, I'll take that. They're really fun, so that's okay. But they just make it up. They just make it up. It's crazy. And I see Nassim Penn ignore it, and there's a lot I ignore. But every now and then, someone gets under my skin, and I go right back at them.
I feel like you're allowed to have one thing you can fight for. You know, I try not to get involved in, you know, the culture wars and all the other 100 things that people seem irate about. But I think you're allowed to champion one thing. And, you know, obviously you have yours. And what I found really interesting when you were giving me some advice is you mentioned when you go through the process of growing your own vegetables, your uptake, you eat so much more. And I imagine it's incredibly rewarding from someone who's never done it. And it's almost a little bit like magic to me, because I was never educated about it at school. I was never educated about it, you know, being fourth generation city person. It's just, you go to a shop and you buy something, and you never think about, how do I do that? And I think once you go through that process, once you grow it, pulls the curtain back. It's a little bit, you know, Wizard of Oz. It pulls it back, and you think, oh, I can do this, and I can do this myself. And, it, you know, I don't have to rely on this enormous supply chain.
I just made a big pot of vegetable soup today, minestrone, from all my own vegetables. So when you, and it tastes so good. And even the oregano that I put in mine. So when you taste it, you're right. There is that, wow, this is really good. I did this. So I said, this pot of soup can be my year end of, you know, the year of 2023, because everything I grew, my heart, my love is all right in there, what I did. So that would be, just show the video of my soup. And that was my year of 2023. And it tastes so good, and it saves money, and it's helping the environment. And when you do, fresh picked foods are most nutritious. Actually, picking them in the morning is when it's most nutritious. So you consider that those tomatoes right now that are coming from Costa Rica or Mexico to my supermarket, you know, you're talking 2,000 miles away, you know, I don't know how many kilometers. That's a long time. They will harvest tomatoes, strawberries when they're green and not ripe. And then they put them in these huge warehouses that they pump in ethylene gas to ripen them. Can you imagine? And you're going to tell me that's sustainable? This big factory that is, I have a few videos on that. It's like, no, this is it. And once the first time I grew an abundance of peppers. So what the heck am I doing with them? I sauteed them more and jarred them. It's just so easy to go take a jar of already cooked peppers and onions, and I could use it for whatever. Because you can't, you know, they go bad pretty quick if you don't use them when you pick them fresh. So those kinds of things, I learned so much just from gardening.
It's a fascinating concept to me. And I want to touch a little bit on the concept of food deserts as well, which I think is quite a uniquely American thing. Coming from Europe, I've spent a lot of time in America, and I don't think we're affected as badly by it here. But I've been to places in America where, and by the way, I'm going to caveat this with, I absolutely love America. It's quite fashionable in Europe to kind of bash America, but I'm the complete opposite. I will defend it to anyone over here. I think it's the best country in the world. But there are food deserts, and I've experienced it with, you know, me and my partner. There's an abundance of cheap processed fatty foods, which make me feel a little bit ill when I eat them in America. I mean, you know, we have fast food over here, of course we do, but you know, it's ultra, ultra processed over there. And if you want to get a salad or something, it's incredibly difficult to do unless you want to spend a lot of money. And it's so expensive to eat healthy in America.
The food deserts are where the people have the least amount of money. So how convenient is it? And you will see, I had an argument with a shill that they're defending McDonald's because McDonald's is employing these people in the food deserts. What's wrong with you? You're supposed to celebrate the shitty food because it's giving them a job. I said, imagine if you took the space of land where that McDonald's is and the parking around it, and instead made that a community garden. Ron Finley, headquarters is his Twitter handle. He is amazing. He took South Central LA food deserts. He did a TED talk on it. He is my mentor. When I saw that, and he has a strip of land everybody has right near the road in the city. It's just a little strip of land. Usually the streetlights are there. Dogs poop all over it. You're going to see crack vials and fentanyl bags and God knows what. That's what we had at the end of my block. And he replaced this strip of land with a vegetable garden, and the city wanted to shut him down. He went through so many legal bureaucratic tape, and now he's thriving. He won, and his garden efforts, homeless people taking empty lots and making them gardens. Philadelphia has 40,000 empty lots, and the landlords are allowing people, yeah, you can't just go on it, and will provide some water. At least it's thriving until maybe you sell it one day to somebody that's going to develop it. But in the meantime, that's Philly. 40,000. I've worked at City Harvest. I've worked at a few of those community gardens. And to see the difference. Oh, Far Rockaway. Do you know the Far Rockaways? The Rockaways in Queens? Mm-hmm. My husband retired out of there years ago. The projects there, the PJs, they got the thumbs up. There's a lot of property around these tall apartment complexes. The city is allowing people to grow food. is amazing what they're growing. Harlem Grown, Tony Hillary at Harlem Grown. It's just, I get so excited. I get goosebumps. It's helping people in the most need with the least amount of money. I had a taste of it when I was hurting so badly financially. I had a taste. And the thought that they could grow their own food. And today you're going to decide what you're preparing for your family by what you harvested in the morning. And they're doing this. Community gardens, there's over 800 of them in Brooklyn alone. And 1/5 of the world's food is grown in urban spaces around the world, usually by people that don't have money to save some money. It's smart. You know, you don't have money, go grow you some food, at least to help offset the costs. And those food deserts don't want you doing that. So there's a lot of programs, a lot of free programs that just get shut down by the agrochemical pharmaceutical companies have a lot of money and they pay a lot of people to make it sound like it's ridiculous. And you see, like, I'll link it to you with Ron Finley, what he went through in South Central LA. What a remarkable man he is, and what an inspiration. And it's working. It's working. People are doing it. We just have to keep spreading the word.
Well, we'll certainly include links to the TED Talk and to his work as well at the end of this and anywhere we post this. I feel no conversation about this would be complete without talking, you know, a little bit about GMOs and the effect they're having. Now, I don't feel like I need to ask your opinion of GMOs. I think I know what the answer would be.
Well, for food, I certainly embracing the genetic engineering that's going on in medicine. Sickle cell anemia, they have had this going for a while. So, and they're doing real thorough testing. And they have now humans that are testing and doing well. Sickle cell is such a painful, painful disease. And the fact that it could help, God bless everybody. Of course, I'm going to celebrate it. Nobody else is harmed by it. The environment, the water is not harmed by it the way a GMO food seed is.
I think there's that classic split, you know, going a little bit into Talebian territory here. But we start talking about the precautionary principle. For people who don't know, if I'm remembering this correctly, you know, it states that if an actionable policy has even a small risk of causing severe harm to any kind of domain, whether that's, you know, the environment, an ecosystem, a population, then action should be taken to prevent that, even in the absence of a solid 100% proof scientific argument. And I think with GMOs, we see that, you know, a little bit, people are pushing, using a little bit of the classic arguments of, oh, you could save millions of lives, increase crop yields. Yes, but if something happens and it gets into that ecosystem, you cannot undo it. There is a step change there, and it is a multiplicative, it's an exponential, non-linear step change, which can absolutely destroy an ecosystem. We do not know anything near enough about these kind of complex systems to be tinkering with them. Whereas, when you look at the medicine side of things, you can do it in a controlled way with a single person or group of people, and that's not going to have an exponential effect. So I agree with you on that split there. I think biotech is going to be the next great revolution of the next 20, 30 years. That's my personal opinion. I feel like we've had a tech revolution in the last 30, 40, 50 years. I think biotech is going to show enormous strides in the next 20 or 30 years. But, you know, this idea of not meddling in complex systems which can have disastrous effects. Certainly, I think anyone who's a fan of Taleb has that sort of built into them to a certain extent. But how dangerous do you see this being?
I see with the food supply, for instance, with genetics, when you're putting a GMO, a gene edited, into the food supply that affects the environment, we have double-pronged concerns. We saw it with the genetically engineered mosquito. They did it in Brazil first. It was being promoted as being sterile and unable to reproduce, and that this will cut down on mosquito-related diseases. Well, there was 5% of the 95% of them that are not sterile, and they started mating with the wild. And they knew that, and yet they still released them in Florida. So I don't know that there's a decrease in any of the mosquito-related diseases. There are some, and there are studies, but I certainly will not take a stand either way, that say pesticides are what caused the Zika virus. So, and that causes all kinds of neural tube deformities, especially in pregnancy, the hydrocephalus, the small microcephalus, small head, and whatnot. Enough that I do not want to mess with a baby. I don't want to mess with the environment. As crazy and deadly as mosquitoes can be for some, they're also part of the food chain. The fish, the bats, anteaters, they eat, they live on mosquitoes. You take away that food source. What are you doing? So I don't think they've tested it enough, but they sure do promote it enough. You look at, oh my goodness, I want to say it was around early 90s. We suddenly had a new GMO insulin. And in the hospital, you're not allowed to administer any medication that came from the patient themselves because you have no idea what that is and they're not going to do a toxicology report. Now, when diabetics were coming in, we couldn't use their insulin, which was mostly made from pork and beef pancreas. That's how insulin always was. This was this new genetically modified insulin. And we were giving it to them and they were having reactions. It took a very long time for them to adapt, which they did. But guess what? There is now monopoly. There is no animal insulin, no beef or pork. And if somebody was allergic to it, we'd have to send them to the UK to order from England, who has reportedly stopped or will be stopping all their pork and beef. They took it over. And on top of that, they raised prices to the point that people, on the average, something like 25 people a year die because they can't afford their insulin. Some were arrested in Canada for buying their insulin over the border. Large senior buses would go into Canada to buy their medications, and they got arrested. They arrested seniors. They can't afford it. And it was sold under the idea that this was going to not only help, but under the impression that animal agriculture is going to decline. That never happened. That was just pure bullshit. And they will promise, the word was promised, to lower the cost, which they didn't. They raised it through the roof. Those kinds of things. No, I'm not against a GMO insulin. I'm against the monopoly over it. It's terrible. So that's where a GMO injected to you subcutaneously under your skin, a little needle, is going to affect that one person if they have a reaction. A GMO in the wild is affecting everything. And the pesticides that and the herbicides like Roundup has become resistant to weeds. So they're using more of the Roundup that we didn't want to harm the environment. Because just like science tells you, you're going to get resistance if you keep using too much. And they don't want you to know science. They want you all to be stupid. And that's where Nassim educates, even though some things he says, I have to look up these words. I have to tell you, I don't know what it means. Keeps telling it, and he'll give you a lot of scenarios that everyone can understand. When I did Real World Risk Institute, I was 16. He invited me as a guest. How excited I was. And I was afraid. I said, I'm not going to know any of this. I learned so much. They cater it to anybody. You take the topic like GMO and everyone can understand it, that precautionary principle. That precautionary principle mostly is for the unknown. You better take precaution. You don't know what the hell it is. Take precaution. I always say pretend it's a baby. Are you going to put them at risk? No, you take all precaution to protect a baby. And that's the precautionary principle, the unknown. So
there's a lot to unpack there. I think partially what you're talking about with the price inflation and the monopolization of it, we're kind of hitting the limits, I feel, of what the patent system was designed to do originally. And we're seeing these pharmaceutical companies now, which are patenting genetic sequences or patenting, you know, something, yeah, genetic sequence, human genetic sequences that we all have inside us, and then using that within medicine. And or protein chains, if not genetics. And then once they have that, once they have the patent on that, they can charge whatever the hell they want for it. And, you know, you're seeing this absolutely enormous increase. You're seeing a lot of, who was that? that farmer bro who went to prison because his entire tactic was buying pharmaceutical companies that had a drug and then just raising the price 2,000% to make his money back. Strzelecki, I can't remember, Martin Strzelecki, I can never pronounce him, but it's a real tactic. And, you know, he joked at the time, I don't like the guy, but I think he said at the time, I'm going to prison because I publicly criticized Hillary Clinton. Pharmaceutical companies are doing this all the time, and I'm just being made an example of. And as much as I dislike the guy, you know, it does seem like there's an endemic of that process happening. Now, as always, I feel with all our best guests, we're coming up to the end of time. We've got 5 minutes left, and I feel like we've only barely scratched the surface. I really wanted to talk to you about COVID more and about what went wrong with COVID, but maybe we can have another hour on that at some point as a returning guest, because, you know, there's a lot to talk about there. I feel like we could have an hour just on COVID.
You know what? If you're willing to, I would, because not only can I tell you what went wrong, you have to go to the past to see what happened wrong in the present, but I also have a few solutions from a realistic point of view, and no way can we do that in 5 minutes. So if you're up for it, I'm up for it another time.
Absolutely. I really would like to. I'd love to chew the fat with you on it. I know we've spoken on Twitter about it, and I think just doing a retrospective on that process as it unfolded, what went wrong, Nassim's early warnings on it, and then just watching, in my failure, the absolute failure of public policy in the UK and America. But, you know, let's have another hour on that another time. Before we wrap up, I know you've given a shout out to nursing, but is there anything else you want to give a shout out to? Is there anywhere people can find you, contact you? The last few minutes, really, is anything you want to shout out or raise?
Well, I'm Homegrown Joan on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok, because TikTok is, although there's crazy stuff going on, you don't have to follow that. The amount of information and garden inspiration on TikTok is perhaps the best. And unfortunately, Twitter is not allowing us to add those fun music to our videos. So TikTok and Instagram are great places. Instagram does shadow ban. Instagram does prevent your info. If you are saying something bad about Dr. Fauci, you're not going to get that in people's feed. But that's okay, because my family and friends are there in real life. And so that's a lot of fun. And of course, Twitter is my activist page. You know, that's where I speak up. But again, without those shills and without Vixen Valentino, I would never have met you or even known that Nassim was on Twitter. And what a great inspiration you all have been for me. And I feel like I have brothers and nephews that are keeping me protected from some of the others. So it feels really good. It's not so isolating anymore. So I'm really happy about that. And I'm all set for Chicago, July. I can't wait.
Yeah, shameless plug for the Fat Tony's July Chicago 2024 meetup. We're going to put links to all of those things you just mentioned below and on the webpage. I'd just like to share about the sentiment that it's been an absolute honor knowing you over the last few years. You are absolutely the aunt of this corner of Twitter.
Oh, I am so humbled by this. I feel the same about you. Oh, you've been wonderful and a lot of laughs. I'm so glad that you started Fat Tony's. It was, again, that's who I identify more with, Fat Tony, than any of the others. But it's so much fun and it's a lot of learning, so much learning. I have a notebook. I'm writing things down when you talk because it's so exciting and so wonderful. And at this stage of my life, to learn so many new things, it's really great. So I love you and I appreciate all that you do. Thank you.
That's so wonderful. Well, on that note, Joan Shields, thank you so much for being a guest. It's been great having you.
And you as well. This is fun. Thank you.